Once upon a time, it was a little girl, and her name was Little Red Riding Hood.
And my father standing there, trained to kill you 5 or 6 different ways by breathing on you funny.
His sister told him that Dad could protect them from nightmares. And that's what I tried to do when they were little.
We love stories!
It's time for the Appleseed, filled with stories for you and your family. I'm Sam Payne, your host. And often the show is filled with folktales and fairy tales, tales of imagination and wonder. And today's stories will be filled with wonder too, we promise, but they'll all be true. We're going to spend an hour with some of our favorite storytellers, each of them telling stories about dads. Some of them have dads that they're anxious to talk about. Some of them are dads themselves, and they'll give you some insight into what it's like not only to have a dad, but to be one. Donna Washington from North Carolina will tell us about the story character that most reminds her of her dad. Alabama storyteller Dolores Hydock will share memories of her dad, thoughts brought on by a long history of Father's Day gifts. And you'll hear some of my own thoughts about a friend of mine, a saxophone player, and a tribute to his dad that I'll never forget. But first, from the terrific Chicago storyteller Sid Lieberman with some thoughts about being a dad himself. You'll see yourself or a dad you love or both in Sid's thoughts. Recorded live before an audience in Jonesboro, Tennessee, here's one of America's great storytellers, Sid Lieberman, with a piece called To Everything There Is a Season. Happy to bring it to you on the Appleseed.
When Zach decided to transfer to Hunter College in New York, he didn't want any help finding a place to live. He was going to do it all by himself. And that's why I was so happy when he accepted my offer to go out and help him move in. I saw it as having quality time with my boy. I was going to take care of him. Now, when the kids were little, that was easy to do. And I liked doing it. I was good at it. In fact, every now and then, I was a genius. Once my daughter came to me, she said, I had a nightmare. I said, nightmare? I can get rid of that nightmare. I have nightmare magic. Her eyes got really big. I had her put her hands on mine. I did all this hocus-pocus stuff. I said, close your eyes and think of something really nice. I said, what are you thinking of? She said, bunny rabbits. I said, that's good. I picked her up, I carried her to bed, and I put her down. I said, keep thinking of those bunny rabbits. And she fell right to sleep. So when Zach was little, he came in the room one night and he tugged on my sleeve, and I woke up and he looked at me and he said, I need some of that nightmare magic. And you know what? I never told him. His sister told him. His sister told him that Dad could protect them from nightmares. And that's what I tried to do when they were little. Sarah was inconsolable when our cat died, a cat that had been there every day of her life. And so I sat her on my lap and I read her The Little Prince, and we talked about life and death and love. And when Zach broke his arm, I remember standing in the emergency room and the doctor said to me, I don't think you want to be here. And I didn't, because I knew what was coming, but Zach didn't. And so when the doctor re-broke the bone in order to set it, and Zach leaped off that bed in pain, at least I was there holding his hand. But then they grow up and try to hold a teenager's hand. Try to protect a teenager, especially some of them. For instance, Zach. When Sarah became a teenager, we never set curfew. We never had to. She would just show up at the right time. It was like living in a teenage twilight zone. But Zach, he was the stuff that sitcoms are made of. When he was a sophomore, he took our car to go out on a date. He came back late, really way past curfew, so late we were already sleeping. He woke us up. My wife and I looked at the clock. We looked at each other. We looked at Zach. I said, Zach, why are you so late? He said, well, I wouldn't have been so late, but on the way home, I got some tickets. He got some tickets. Well, he didn't want to miss curfew. He wound up with 2 speeding tickets and 1 for reckless driving. Later that same year, he went out with the same girl to her junior prom. She was an older woman. He wanted to be out all night. We said, nah, 2 a.m. curfew. 2 a.m. comes, he shows up. I thought, hey, we're getting somewhere with the boy. We went back to sleep. A little bit later, we heard this crash. I searched through the whole house, and I discovered there's a window open in the basement. I came back up to my wife. I said, you know what? I think someone was trying to break in. It never occurred to us that it was Zach breaking out. He even put a fake body in the bed with a blanket over it. We never saw it. We were so naive, we never went into his room to check. But he got his just rewards. I was afraid the burglars were going to come back. I nailed the window shut. He couldn't get back in, and it poured that night. I found him the next day out on our front porch, sleeping in a fetal position, looking like a drowned rat. But now, a few years later, he was asking me to go out and take care of him. And I thought, this is going to be a special day. But as soon as I got there, things were wrong. We began to fight about everything. And I realized very quickly that he didn't want his father there taking care of him. What he wanted was somebody who could buy things. Someone who could rent a car to put them in, and someone who could help them carry him up the steps of his apartment. What he really wanted was a rich Sherpa. Well, we spent the morning buying things, and then we had to get a desk. And everybody in New York said, IKEA. Go to IKEA. It was like Mecca. Go to Mecca. So I went to IKEA, an hour and a half one way on the Long Island Expressway. But I didn't know I was going to IKEA not to buy a desk. I was going to IKEA to buy parts to build a desk. Well, I don't watch Home Improvement. But we bought about 300 parts. We had baskets filled with stuff. I said to the guy, do we have everything? He says, yep. Got back to Brooklyn. We don't have everything. I have to drive back to IKEA another 3 hours in New York traffic. By the time I got back to Brooklyn the second time, I was crazy. I'd been in New York traffic for 6 hours. I had to build a desk and I didn't know how. I've been fighting with Zach all day long and I'm sitting there fuming and he looks at me and he said, you know, Dad, when you're acting like this, I can't be with you. A little while later, we're going to dinner. I thought, I have to explain to him how I'm feeling. And I begin the explanation walking down the street. And he says, do we have to keep talking about this? I left 4 hours early for my plane. I didn't want to be there one more minute. A year later, we went back to New York. I'd been seriously ill during the year. And I was waiting into the hotel room for my doctor to call with some test results. Adrian went down to meet Zach and a new girlfriend. I came down a little bit later, and he greeted me, gave me a hug, introduced me to the girl, and he asked, how are you? Well, I didn't know what he told the girl about what was going on. I didn't want to go into a whole big thing. I said, I'm fine. The test results were good, and they were good. And we started to go to lunch, and Adrian was walking with the girl, and Zach was walking with me. And Zach did something that I'm never going to forget. He's taller than me now. And as we walked along, he threw his arm over my shoulders, and he leaned toward me and he asked, so how are you really? And as we walked down the street with his arm around my shoulders, I thought to myself, this is it. This is the future. A year ago, I'd gone to New York to take care of my boy. A year later, he's got his arm around my shoulders and he's taken care of me. And I've had a taste of that future. The family went to Paris for a vacation. I was feeling better. 10 days in Paris, a celebration. On the second day in Paris, I stepped out of a bathtub, fell, and cracked 2 ribs. It was awful. Every date was like, who's going to stay with the old man while the other two go out? But I didn't want to ruin the vacation, and so I put a good face on it. I read, I watched French television, even though I don't understand French. I listened to the sightseeing tales at the end of the day. But on the way home, I lost it. On the plane, I was exhausted. My defenses were down. I just watched a sappy movie, and I began to cry. But I mean, sob. I was sobbing. People were looking like, what's happening? Adrian and Sarah were sitting in front of me. Zach was in the back. Adrian came over. She sat down, and she commiserated. And she said, I'll send the kids. And Sarah came over, and she sat down, and she took my hand and looked at me and started crying. It was very Sarah, and also very therapeutic. We just sat and cried together. We never said a word to each other. And then Sarah left, and Zach came over, and he sat down, and he got in close to my ear, and he said to me, hey, come on, Dad, don't worry about it. There'll be other vacations. Listen, you know, you're getting better. You're going to be fine, Dad. You're going to be fine. I thought to myself, it's like I'm a boxer, just been knocked down. And he's my manager, getting me ready to go off for the next round. And I did go out. And I was fine. And I've been fine for many rounds since. But I know I'm going to be knocked down again. I'm getting older. There's no getting around that. I know that everything, there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to live and a time to die. A time to get and a time to lose. A time to sow and a time to reap. And I know now a time to take care of your children and a time for them to take care of you.
Sid Lieberman with To Everything There Is a Season. There's a lot coming up on the Appleseed as we continue to think about what it's like to have a dad, or to be a dad, or to love a dad. We'll hear from the North Carolina storyteller Donna Washington with a tale about the traditional storytelling character that Donna thinks of when she thinks of her dad. That's next on the Appleseed. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to the Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to the Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
I'm excited to be able to share these stories today in celebration of dads. Whether you have one or love one or are one, the stories we're sharing today are for you. It was such a pleasure to hear from a dad, the great Chicago storyteller Sid Lieberman. Sid is no longer with us, but his legacy of stories continues to delight and inspire. We were happy to bring that story to you today. And to introduce us to the next story we're going to hear, I'm pleased to have with me Jeff Simpson, the producer of the Appleseed. Jeff, it's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear here.
Well, this is going to be a road trip story about Donna Washington and her family, but mainly about her dad.
Yeah.
And who her dad reminds her of. And it happens to be a literary character, Br'er Rabbit, this
right.
character that gets in and out of trouble all the time. And if I were to think about who reminds me of my dad, it's probably Robin Williams from the movie Mrs. Doubtfire. Thankfully, he's not that reckless, but he's hilarious, and we just have so much fun when we're together. And he does lots of voices, too.
Well, if this story makes you think a little bit about who your dad reminds you of, well, we wouldn't blame you. Here's Donna Washington with a little Father's Day story here on the Appleseed.
Now, when I was a child, I heard a lot of Br'er Rabbit stories. And I thought he was fictional. What I didn't know is that I grew up with him. My father is a very unusual man. And he had a guilty secret that I knew nothing about until it was the weekend or we were traveling across country. You see, my father has no fashion sense. Every day of his life, the army told him what to wear, but when they weren't telling him, he wore anything. He was the black socks and the sandals and the ripped-up shorts and the T-shirt with holes, or sometimes the T-shirt would be lovely and the shorts would have holes. We were mortified to go anywhere with this man. Now, my mother, on the other hand, always perfect, always matching, very prim, very prissy, very precise. Now, when we were kids, because we were in the army, every now and again, every 3 or 4 years, actually, we would have to move across country. And the way most army families did it was the moving van would move up to their houses, and they would put all of their whole goods, their baggage, into the moving van. They would strap the family car onto the back of the moving van, and it would drive away, leaving them standing there with just their luggage. They would get into a cab, go to a hotel, and then to the airport, fly over the country and land somewhere and be at their new home. That's not how we did it. My father had an attitude about America. He said, "I fought for this country. You're gonna see it." He bought a van that sat 26 people. They don't even make them that large for domestic consumption anymore. He bought it out in California in the 80s, back in the day before they started shooting people out of their cars and they banned the windows that you couldn't see into the car. Well, he had all the windows open like that. You couldn't see in at all. Just big black windows all the way around this huge van. And when we went across country, my father would take the two front seats out and put them in the moving van. And that's where the dogs and the ferret stayed up there in the front seat when we were going across the country. Because we had an Alsatian Shepherd, the big black and silver dog that looks like a wolf. We had a toy poodle, and we had a big cage wherein lived Ricky, our albino ferret. Then we would sit two to a seat, and in the back seat, which was the long seat, whoever was tired could lay down back there and sleep. All of the luggage went either on top of the car or behind that back seat where there was still room to put the luggage. And then we would drive, winding slowly across America. And as soon as my father, big, strong, frightening-looking man, would get in the car, boom, he'd slam the door and become Mr. Happy Driving Man. Nothing bothered him. He's driving across the country going, look at this, look at this, look at this. Aha! Isn't that fun? Let's stop and do this. Let's stop and buy something. Isn't this great? And my mother would ride roughshod over us in the back seat. Everyone sit down. Don't touch him. Put that down. That's not yours. Don't eat that. And we would listen to what my mother said because she was in charge. Because when my father was in the car, you could forget it. Now, the way we traveled across country was that we would get up at oh dark 30, which means well before the sun or anything else. And we'd get in the car, and my father would drive and drive and drive. And we woke up a couple hours later, really, and my mother would hand out fruit or snacks, and we would eat those until we found a Denny's or something like that. And then we would stop there, and we would eat breakfast. Well, at one point, when I was in high school, we moved from Oklahoma to Virginia by way of Florida. And so, of course, we were going to move, and so my father took the front two seats out, and we loaded most of our stuff into the moving van, and then we put all the luggage in there, and we put the dogs in there and the cage, and we got in the car and strapped ourselves in and started winding south and west, south and east, north, south, looking at stuff. Look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this. Ha-ha! And my mother sort of rushed all over everybody. But there came a night where we were driving for so long that there was no place open when we pulled in. And so we couldn't get fruit or anything. And we got up so early, nothing was open. And we all got back in the car. Now, it was the 80s at this point, and we all had big Jerry Curl afros. And when we rolled out of bed at oh dark 30, not a one of them was combed. And there were big knobs all over our heads. My father, of course, fresh as a daisy. Aha, it's time to drive. My mother came out of the hotel, and she was wrinkled. This is a bad sign. She got to the front of the car. She grabbed the handle. We must stop and get coffee. My father said, okay. We got in the car. My father started off. The seven of us immediately fell asleep in the back seat. And my father's just driving, ha-ha! And my mother is sitting in the front seat. We drive for quite some time. Still no coffee. My mother is beginning to grow fangs. And we finally wake up in the back seat. But we have not got anything to pass out. There's no fruit. There's nothing to eat. Have you ever been in close quarters with children who are hungry? World War III breaks out in the back of the van. Mommy's got my thing, mommy's got my thing, mommy's touching me, mom, I'm hungry, mom, I'm this, mom, 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 mom. My mother says, shut up! She turns to my father, we must stop and feed these children and get some coffee. He says, okay. We are somewhere in the deep south. My father sees a dirt road winding off of the little two-lane highway we're on. He turns off of the highway. My mother, who has unrolled the official AAA map looking for something for us to stop at, goes, where are you going? My father says, it's a shortcut. Ha ha. So we drive up into the trees. And now we're not arguing. We're looking out the windows. Where are we going? I don't know. Finally, we come to a flattened area because we've sort of been winding upwards. And we kind of come out of the bushes, and in this flattened area, it must be some kind of hiking trail that connects to this because it's like a little five and dime type of job there, a little store where hikers might stop by, or maybe it services the local area. And there are two old white men playing checkers on the front on this old dilapidated porch. And I can just imagine what those men saw. This huge bus comes breaking out of the trees. And you can't see into it. All the windows are solid black. And it pulls up in front of this teeny little store. And out of one side comes this mountainous man wearing black sandals, black socks, ratty shorts, and a nice pressed t-shirt. The other side opens, out comes a tiny, disgruntled-looking woman. The back door opens, and out come 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 heavily afroed children with a wolf on a leash. By the time we finish walking the dog, they're gone. And we close up the car, and we go into the little five and dime store, and my mother takes one look around this place and says, "Don't get anything that is not in a wrapper." Which means we're having Hostess Twinkies for breakfast. And we run over and we start getting Hostess Twinkies and Hostess Ding Dongs and Hostess Cupcakes. This is the best breakfast ever. And my mother refuses to drink the coffee. She gets a Coke instead. And my father, always one for the local color, gets himself a big jar of pickled pig's feet. We go to the counter and we put the bounty upon the counter. Now, the two men who have been playing checkers have come inside the store, and they're standing on either side of the fella who's running the cash register. And his name is Sam, and we know that because it says so right on his pocket. Sam. And Sam doesn't pick up the food and start checking it out. He doesn't say anything, really. He looks at my father's big man, and he looks at my brothers and sisters, and he looks at my mother. He looks back at my dad. He says, "Y'all ain't from around here, are you?" And then he reaches underneath the counter, grabs something, and there is an audible click. And my father was staring at him. And he looked back down and he saw us, and we didn't know what was going on. And my mother meets his eyes. And my father stood up to his enormous height, put his hands on his hips, and said, "No, we are from the West Indies, and we are traveling in your country." And the man said, "Well, welcome to America," and started ringing up the food. And my father was talking about a big sky and a big ocean and a big road, and we having a big time, and he was laughing with my dad, and he was just ringing stuff up, and we were trying not to laugh. We were all standing there. When it was all done, the man said, "Well, I hope you enjoy your visit." My father said, "We are having a great time," and he ushered us all out of the store. And we got in the car, and we just broke up. We were laughing so hard about old Sam and how my father tricked old Sam. We were ripping into Hostess Twinkies and Hostess Ding Dongs and Hostess Cupcakes. And my father and mother drove very quietly down that dirt road. We got back on that two-lane highway, and we did not make any more detours the rest of that trip. And I think about that moment in my life. That moment when my family was in great jeopardy. And my father standing there, trained to kill you 5 or 6 different ways by breathing on you funny, was faced with that situation. And I realize that at that moment in my life, I had seen Br'er Rabbit doing some of his finest work.
A story filled with all kinds of stuff to think about from Donna Washington. A story about her dad, a little bit about why he reminds her of Brer Rabbit. And it's been a pleasure to listen to that story with Jeff Simpson, our producer. Jeff, thanks for bringing that story to us.
Thanks for letting me be here. Now, Sam, real quick, who comes to mind when you think about your dad? If your dad were to be a celebrity, who would he be?
Listen, we play that game sometimes. Maybe you have two of, like, who would play you in the movie?
Yeah,
of you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
For my dad, Robert Duvall, straight up.
I can see
no
that,
question.
Sure.
Yeah. Happy to have brought this story to you. And again, if it makes you think of who your dad reminds you of, we wouldn't blame you. Lots more coming up on the Appleseed. In fact, up next, a story about a friend of mine and a tribute from my friend to his dad, for which I had something of a front row seat. It's the story of my pal Dennis Zwang. Happy to bring it to you here on the Appleseed. I want to introduce you to Dennis Zwang. This is Dennis. And this is Dennis. Dennis is a woodwind player, one of the coolest cats I ever made music with. He was older than any of the other band members by half a generation. Tall and thin, gray, soft-spoken. Dutch-Indonesian, he was. His father had moved the family to California from Holland in the 60s. And early in their stay here in the Land of Opportunity, Dennis's little sister got sick. And there wasn't enough money for both the hospital stay in faraway Utah and a hotel room. So Dennis's father stayed in the hospital room all day and slept on a bench in the park at night. We loved Dennis. We loved playing with him. We loved learning from the wisdom of the elder statesman of the band. And I remember driving to a gig in Las Vegas once in a big van, and the guitar player next to me shouting up to Dennis in the passenger seat of the van, "Hey, Dennis, you're a vegetarian, right? I know you don't eat beef, but what about other stuff, like chicken?" Dennis turned coolly around and looked at us over the top of his glasses, and through his big gray mustache, he said, "Nothing with a face, man." And we spent the rest of the drive wondering if that included shrimp. Or I remember another time, getting ready to play a big show in a summer concert season in southern Utah. The gig was on Friday, but by Tuesday, I was calling the band just to make sure everyone was ready to take the stage like gangbusters. And we were really gonna kill it. I called Carlisle, the bass player. Yeah, he was stoked to do the show. Corky, the drummer, totally jazzed. Ryan, the guitarist, thumbs way up. And then I called Dennis. "Oh, yeah," he said. "The Friday show." "Yeah, I'm good." "What, are you okay, Dennis?" "Yeah, I'm fine. A little melancholy, maybe. My dad died this afternoon. The funeral is on Friday, but it's early in the day. I think I can still make the gig." "Oh, Dennis, geez, I'm sorry. Hey, don't worry even a tiny bit about the gig. We all know you need to be there with your family that evening. We'll get by. You've got our thoughts and prayers." And a bit of a silence on the other end of the phone then. And Dennis breaks it. "I think I'd like to play," he said. Well, when I got off the phone, I was a little dazed myself. Here was Dennis, the horn player, insisting that he come play a gig on the very day of his father's funeral. I prepared myself all week for him to call sometime between Tuesday and Friday to tell me that it wasn't going to work out, that he did, in the end, need to miss the show. And sure enough, there we were at load-in for the gig 2 hours before showtime. Drum kit set up, no Dennis. Microphones arranged, no Dennis. Instruments tuned and everybody sound checked, no Dennis.
And just as we were all nodding knowingly at each other that we'd have to do the show without him, which we were, of course, willing to do, had been planning to do even, Dennis pulled up outside the theater. And he walked in, carrying saxophone and flute cases slung over his shoulders. He was wearing the dark suit he must have worn earlier that day to his father's funeral. Well, we greeted him, and he greeted us. But in the end, he shuffled past and sat in the wings on a folding chair, slowly and silently opening cases, soaking reeds, assembling horns. None of us knew what to expect that night. And then the show began.
Rise up and shine, my friend. It's time for everything left undone today. Rise up and shine, my friend. The door is open like our getaway way. Our door, they've held you down.
Everyone played great. Dennis was on fire. Every solo right in the pocket. Every fill exactly perfect. And the audience was eating him up. We played Ellington's tune in a mellow tone, and Monk's Blue Monk. We played Autumn Leaves, and All God's Chillin' Got Rhythm.
Well, All God's Chillin' Got Rhythm. All God's Chillin' Got Swing. Well, maybe they haven't got money. Maybe they haven't got shoes. But All God's Chillin' Got Rhythm. Just to chase away those blues. I said, All God's Chillin' Got that trouble. Oh, trouble don't mean a thing. Cause when you start to sing, ha ha ho de ho, all your troubles go away. Hey, All God children got swing. Bleep bleep da 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 da
da da da da. And then it came time to play George Gershwin's great tune, Love Is Here to Stay. The song was the last composition Gershwin ever wrote. It was for the 1938 film The Goldwyn Follies. It's in An American in Paris, too. And the lyrics of the song were written after George's death by his brother, Ira, one of America's great lyricists. It's very clear our love is here to stay, not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go, but oh, my dear, our love is here to stay. And that night, on stage, we begin the song.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movie that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go, but oh, my dear.
Now, I'm the singer in this band, but I'm also the band leader, and one of the jobs of a band leader is to pass the solos around. Band leader will get done singing a verse and then nod and point to the guitar player, who will solo through a couple of choruses, and then the band leader and the guitar player will make eye contact and communicate with each other that it's someone else's turn, and the band leader will hand the solo off to someone else. And eventually, after all the solos the song seems to want, the band leader will come back in. And so it went that night, that as the band leader, after the opening chorus of the tune, I nodded to Dennis, and out he came. a solo. It was something. Waves of saxophone melody spiraling up through the air and out over the audience. I never heard Dennis play like that. Through a double chorus he went, and we were all carried away by it. And when that second chorus was winding down, I walked over to Dennis to take the handoff and send the solo to another player. His eyes were closed as he played. So I touched him lightly on the elbow. And as I did, he elbowed me smoothly but very firmly aside. The band began to move through another chorus, and Dennis, he kept playing. Up, up, and up that solo went through a third chorus, a fourth. I looked at Dennis's face. His eyes were shut tight. Big tears were rolling down his cheeks as he played and played. And we were, all of us, whether on stage or in the audience or backstage on the crew, lifted up on the wings of that solo. Ah, I wish I had a recording of it to play you right here, but I don't. All I can do is tell you. As Dennis played and played, we all knew why he had wanted to come that night. We all knew for whom he was playing and who it was that was listening. The notes coming from Dennis' saxophone rose up through the theater like prayers, like embraces, like farewells. I directed the other musicians through the ending of the tune. Dennis kept playing. I love you, Dad. It's been 4 days and I miss you, Dad. Here are all the things I said and all the things I should have taken back and all the things I never said but should have. It was a miracle solo, up and up and up and then down and down. And Dennis's saxophone prayer quieted, and after a long time, before a silent band, went silent itself. No one breathed. Silence. Silence. And then applause. Shouts. And finally, Dennis opened his eyes. The applause swelled, went on and on and on. I don't think Dennis even heard it. For him, the only two people in the theater at all were he and his dad. The boy saying goodbye in a way to crack the heavens wide open. And the heavens jerked to attention by the playing of that saxophone.
But my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we going along. Gibraltar may tumble, they're oddly made of clay, but our love is here.
If you're just joining us, we're spending an hour in celebration of Father's Day with stories about dads,
That was a story about Dennis Zwang and a tribute to his dad, for which I had something of a front row seat. Happy to bring it to you here on the Appleseed. Dolores Hydock up next with memories brought on by Father's Day gift giving. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to the Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
We're so glad you're with us for an hour filled with father stories, stories about and even by dads. And we want to bring you now a performance recorded live before a lovely audience from the Alabama storyteller Dolores Hydock. Dolores's stories give us lighthearted and meaningful opportunities to think about what our relationships mean. And the things she'll share here come to mind through the window of something a lot of us have some experience with, the giving of Father's Day gifts. Here's Dolores Hydock with a story called Independence on the Appleseed.
For some reason that I no longer remember, one year when I was growing up, we were late celebrating Father's Day. I don't remember if my dad was away or my mother was sick. I don't remember why. But for some reason, we celebrated Father's Day 2 weeks late on the first Sunday in July, which also happened to be the 4th. And so we combined our two little family celebrations, Father's Day and Independence Day. My sister Alice, the designated family party decorator, festooned the dining room with red, white, and blue crepe paper streamers, a medley of John Philip Sousa marches paraded out of the record player in the living room, and a menu of hamburgers, corn on the cob, and apple pie preceded the presentation of Father's Day gifts from my two sisters and me. From Lisa, a necktie. From Alice, a necktie. And from me, a reversible necktie. I hadn't thought about that family gathering in a long time, but I was going through a shoebox full of old photographs, and I came across this black and white photo of my smiling dad sitting that day at that little gathering, sitting there at one end of the dining room table wearing three neckties, my two sisters and me clustered around him, looking so pleased and proud that our presence had been so well received and were apparently such a surprise. I didn't think about it at that time, of course, but later on, as I was looking at that photo, I thought, well, that's really pretty appropriate to celebrate those two holidays together, Independence Day and Father's Day, because that's one of the things our fathers often give us. Independence. At least that's one of the things my dad gave me. Our mothers sort of love us in a way that holds us close to them, but fathers often love us in a way that sends us out into the world, able to navigate independently. When I was 5, for instance, my parents got me my first real two-wheeled bike. It was tiny and tan with little white stars on the fenders and training wheels. And the first few times I rode it, my dad walked along beside me, holding on, steadying me. And then when he thought I was ready, and way before I thought I was ready, he gave a little extra shove and let go and said, "Go on, you can do it. I'll watch you from here." I sailed off down the sidewalk, terrified but exhilarated too, traveling the world under my own steam, going further and faster than ever before. Over the next several weeks, without my realizing it, my dad gradually tilted those training wheels up off the ground so that they were pretty much more wings than wheels. And one day, I found the bike there in the garage, supported only by the kickstand. I looked over at my dad. He was working under the hood of the black and white Chevy. He didn't even look over at me. He just said, "Go on, you can do it. I'll watch you from here." And I could do it. And my world got wider and faster as I graduated to the metallic blue Schwinn with the basket and bell, then the English bike, sleek, black, with razor-thin 26-inch wheels, then back to four wheels again, the chestnut brown Ford Galaxy 500 in which my dad taught me to drive. He'd come find me on a Sunday afternoon, jangle the car keys, say, "Come on, Schluggo, let's go for a ride."
would find a quiet neighborhood or a parking lot where I could practice steering and stopping and three-point turns. And even today, on those rare occasions when I actually have to parallel park, I can still hear his voice in the back of my mind reciting like some kind of poem in free verse. Aim for the curb in the middle of the space. Now straighten, straighten, watch out for the tree. I had a habit when I was learning to drive of constantly checking my rear view mirror, curious, I guess, about what was coming up behind me. It was a habit that drove my dad crazy. He would say to me, "Watch where you're going, not where you've been." Advice I'd do well to follow in the rest of my life journey as well. He taught me how to use a plunger and a socket wrench. Taught me to measure twice, cut once. Advice I later realized applies as well to love affairs as it does to lumber. When I was in freshman year of college and my high school sweetheart, Ricky Sedlak, broke my heart, my dad wrote me a letter of comfort and sympathy, included the words to a song that he thought might make me feel better. The song went, "When you're feeling all alone in the world and a little bit out of tune, just pick up your hat, get out of the flat, get out and under the moon. Look up at the moon's shimmering face, shining all night long. And remember, the world is a big old place, but it still needs to hear your song. So whenever you're feeling alone in the world and a little bit out of tune, just pick up your hat, get out of the flat, get out and under the moon." He'd taken the time to write out all those verses. But I was 18 years old and melodramatic and far too devastated by my heartache to be comforted by such simple words. Get out and under the moon. Yeah, right, Dad. But it was another gift of independence from my dad, advice I just didn't understand yet about keeping things in perspective, about picking yourself up and dusting yourself off and getting on with things. In a lifetime of Father's Day presents, nothing I ever gave him, no wallet, no belt, not even the truly remarkable reversible tie, could ever compare to the gifts he gave me. Advice, tools, a set of skills to help me navigate the world independently. And all of it given with the kind of love that lets go and says, "Go on, you can do it. I'll watch you from here."
Yeah. Dolores Hydock with a story called Independence here on the Appleseed. In an hour's worth of stories in celebration of Father's Day. You know, when I hear about the neckties Dolores Hydock talks about there, I think about my own closet full of neckties given to me, or my dad's closet full of neckties that I've given him. Great stories bring to mind our own experiences and memories. They invite us to share them with the people we love. And we always hope that the stories that we bring you here on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people that you love. Now, earlier in the hour, we heard a story from Donna Washington about her dad, who Donna compared to Brer Rabbit, the trickster hero of countless stories about escaping by wit and luck. And we're fortunate to have a recording preserved by Donna of her dad's actual voice, his storytelling. As it turns out, Donna isn't the only storyteller in her family. Here's a recording of Dad telling a story to little Donna years and years ago. It seems just the right capstone to an hour of stories about dads. Here's Donna Washington's dad here on the Appleseed.
The following story was recorded back in the summer of 71 or 72, and I replay it here with my father's permission. Back in those days, my nickname was Dickle. This story is called Little Red.
Once upon a time, it was a little girl. And her name was Little Red Riding Hood. Now, Little Red Riding Hood was always going to Grandma's house, lived in the woods. Now, you know an old lady like that didn't have any business living in the woods, right, Dick?
Right on.
Okay. Well, anyway, Little Red Riding Hood was going out through the forest one day, and she saw this wolf who was laying over by the trail checking her out. So Little Red Riding Hood say, "Hey, wolf, what's happening?" And the wolf say, "Everything's cool, everything's cool. How you doing, little lady?" Say, "I'm doing just fine." He says, "Well, hey, look here." He says, "What you got in that basket?" Says, "I've got some cookies from my grandma. You want one?" He says, "Yeah, that's cool. I'll take one." So he chopped the cookie down right quick. He says, "By the way, where your grandma live?" "So she lives over the hill on Dale." He says, "That's cool, too." He said, "Well, I'll check you then." He says, "Later for you." So off she goes on down the street to grandma's house. Okay. Little Red, just skipping along, picking flowers. She should have went on over to grandma's house and quit fooling around in the woods, right, Dick? Mm-hmm. Okay, but what she did, see, she's picking flowers, so the wolf beat her to grandma's house. So when the wolf got over grandma's house, he knocked on the door. Grandma said, "Who is it?" He says, "It's Little Red Riding Hood, Grandma." So that's cool. Come on in, Little Red. So goes in, and it's the wolf, and grandma sees him and runs out of the house. So Little Red comes on over, she knocks on the door. Ding, 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 ding. The wolf looks, says, trying to sound like his grandma. He says, "Who is it?" Says, "It's Little Red, Grandma." "So come on in." She's fine, fine. So she's opened the door and she runs in. So she says, "Oh, Grandma, you're in bed." Grandma says, "Yeah, what do you expect, old lady like me? I'm in bed." Says, "Ooh, Grandma, what big eyes you have." Says, "All the better to see you with, my dear." Says, "Ooh, Grandma, what a big nose you have." Says, "All the better to smell you with, my dear." He says, "Ooh, Grandma, what big ears you have." "All the better to hear you with, my dear." He says, "Ooh, Grandma, what big teeth you have." He says, "All the better to eat you with, my dear." And the wolf leaped up out of the bed, and Goldilocks, what's the little girl name? Little Red Riding Hood hit him in the jaw and cold cocked him right on the spot. The man didn't have a chance. It was an up and down fight. The wolf was laying dead getting his wind. Just as a matter of fact, just as he got his wind, he saw the fags in the corner. He reached over and got the fags. He says, "I guess I'm gonna have to kill this woman." So he came at Little Red Riding Hood with the fags, and Little Red ran out the door. And as Little Red was running out the door, she ran down the street. She says, "Help! This wolf is trying to kill somebody with her axe." And then this hunter came upon him. So the hunter had him an axe too. So the wolf and the hunter stood up with the axe, and in comes Grandma with some sexy clothes on. And Grandma said, "Kill the wolf! Kill the wolf!" And the hunter says, "Well, I'm trying, woman." So the hunter swung at the wolf, and the wolf swung at the hunter, and then the hunter hit the wolf in the head and killed him dead. Oh, my goodness. So Little Red said, "Come on, Grandma. Let's take the hunter home and make him at home. Can you dig a dick?"
"Yeah, that's cool."
Okay, so like, cool. So like, they took him home, and they fed him and everything, and then you know what happened? Grandma and Little Red Riding Hood ate the hunter all up. Didn't give the cat a chance. Gobble him down, just like cannibals, right? You want anything to say?
Just one thing.
What is it? You like that story?
I wish there wasn't a name for that story.
There is a name for that story. It's called Little Red Riding Hood and Grandma Gobbles Up the Wolf. You believe it? That sound like it's true?
Daddy, go ahead and continue.
No, I'm through now, Dick, okay? Let's play it. You want to play it back?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Washington's dad in a recording preserved by Donna. And you can find so much more of Donna's work at her website. Look her up for all kinds of good stuff. Donna Washington. Thanks for being with us for a great hour of dad stories from some of our favorite storytellers. We've heard from Donna Washington. We've heard from the great Alabama storyteller Dolores Hiedock. We heard from Sid Lieberman, the Chicago storyteller, at the top of the hour. We even heard about my pal Dennis Zwang and his saxophone prayer in tribute to his dad on the occasion of his dad's passing. You can find us online at byuradio.org/appleseed, an archive of episodes there filled with stories, many of which will already be favorites, and many more that will become favorites as you listen. Great stories and great tellers from all over. Our audio engineer is Carly Robison. Our producer is Jeff Simpson. I'm Sam Payne, and I can't wait to be with you again on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by The Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.
Hey, it's me, Sam. Just one more quick thing before you go. We love having you with us on The Appleseed, and there's a lot more at BYU Radio that you'll enjoy. Top of Mind, The Lisa Show, Constant Wonder, all available as podcasts and at byuradio.org. Give a listen, yeah?